It took a while for the Beach Boys to get any recognition outside the United States. Their first period of stardom in the early 1960s was so rooted in a particularly American, particularly Californian youth culture of surfing and drag racing hot rods, it didn't really resonate much on the other side of the Atlantic. Hell, it didn't really resonate too much on the other side of the Rocky Mountains. They've got a song from 1965 called The Girl from New York City that kind of treats even New York as an exotic foreign land. By the middle of the decade, America had a very specific image of who the Beach Boys were, which is why it was so difficult for them to remain popular as they began to take their music in a darker, more experimental direction as the 60s went on. Music nerds in the US think of the late 60s and early 70s as the Beach Boys crossing the desert years. They put out some good songs, some good albums, but had almost no commercial success. The Beach Boys, as the public knew them, were dead. But that's really only true where the Stars and Stripes flew. Britain and the rest of Europe were only beginning to catch the wave. They had several number one hits in the late 60s on European charts with songs that, if you're American, you may have never heard of. The boys' now legendary 1966 album Pet Sounds, where they moved on from cars, guitars, and surfboards toward emotional, introspective lyrics and elaborate orchestral arrangements, was one of their worst-selling albums yet in the US, but their first to be a commercial success in the UK. And as the Beach Boys swarmed British beachheads, the Limeys began to also take interest in the mythologized Southern California where their original hits were set. In 1967, the British music magazine New Music Express, NME, wrote about the boys in the terms an American magazine would have written about them in 1962. They said that, "When they're on the stage at Asbury Park, Finsbury Park, or the Paris Olympia, the girls gaze longingly at Dennis Wilson, the mad, impetuous drummer. They imagine the sandy beaches of Malibu filled with Dennises, tall, strapping, athletic youths, grabbing their surfboard with a cry of joy, paddling out over white-capped waves silhouetted against the brilliant sunset. Never meet your idols." Daryl Dragon, better known as the Captain in the duo Captain and Tennille, said that Dennis had an energy that was turbulent. Dragon worked with Dennis throughout the 1970s. He compared Dennis to, like, watching a volcano. You say, "That's pretty," and someone else will say, "But it killed 500 people," and you say, "But it's still pretty." The Beach Boys without Dennis Wilson was like looking at Vesuvius when it wasn't blowing up. I've talked about the Beach Boys on this channel before. My previous Beach Boys episode focused on their troubled visionary bassist and main songwriter, Brian Wilson, about whom Dennis said, "Brian Wilson is the Beach Boys. He is the band. We're his fucking messengers. He is all of it. Period. We're nothing. He's everything." But Dennis was underselling himself there. In fact, for all the music world's adulation for Brian today, the Beach Boys are one of the most democratic bands I know. The only other band where I can really say every member brought something equally important to the table was the Beatles. The Beach Boys had another troubled visionary, one whose life had its own fascinatingly dark twists and turns, including a direct involvement with one of America's most infamous criminals. I didn't talk about Dennis at all in my Brian Wilson episode because his story ultimately requires its very own episode. Here's that one. This is the story of Dennis Wilson. I'm your host, Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts, Jollibee the Durian and Thimble the Doll, and welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Dennis Wilson loved people, and people loved Dennis Wilson. That was his biggest strength and his biggest flaw. A lot of the things that went wrong in his life went wrong because he was ultimately too trusting. You don't want to do that. In real life, just like online, you want to trust, but verify. I can't remember who said this, and I can't find this quote now, but there's a quote from some famous music critic, maybe Robert Christgau, saying that one of the best things about becoming a music nerd is discovering that the Beach Boys are actually the weirdest band in the world. Probably because of their name and nothing else, their public image to this day zeroes in on the few years at the start of their career where they were the high priests of 60s beach culture, which is a little bit like if every stereotype of the United States somehow came from Portland, and everyone outside the country was like, America? Yeah, it's a big country that's rainy and everyone bikes everywhere and they're all goth and smoke weed and every now and then trust fund kids set dumpsters on fire and yell at cops on behalf of black people, even though there are barely any black people in America at all. The Beach Boys contain multitudes. More distinct eras than David Bowie, more interpersonal drama than Fleetwood Mac, more bootlegs and ephemera than the Grateful Dead, more drugs, depression, and tragedy than Nirvana, more genres pioneered than the Beatles. The core of the band consisted of the three Wilson brothers, Brian the superhuman songwriter, Carl the superhuman singer and guitarist, and Dennis the superhuman. Their cousin Mike Love was intended to be the frontman, and the band's almost half-century career was dominated by the tug-of-war between Mike's preference for accessible commercial songs and Brian's devotion to composing and innovating. But there's every bit as much a duality between Brian and Dennis. Brian was the introvert, Dennis the extrovert. Dennis was a party animal, married 5 times, twice to the same woman, and once to Mike Love's illegitimate teenage daughter. Where Brian's struggles involved him retreating further and further into the landscapes of his own mind, the worst crises Dennis ever got into were generated by his naive trust and genuine desire to be around interesting people. Brian was a sickly nerd, probably autistic, with lifelong health issues. Dennis was an athletic ladies' man. In fact, he was the only Beach Boy who was actually an avid surfer in real life. But it was Dennis, who was the black sheep of the Wilson clan, growing up. The Wilson brothers grew up in a musical household under their abusive stage dad, Murray Wilson, who encouraged his sons to start playing instruments and writing songs as soon as they could walk, when he wasn't also beating them senseless. When Brian was a toddler, Murray played piano for hours by his crib. Years later, Murray hit Brian with a 2x4, causing him to go deaf in one ear. Which is why Beach Boys albums were usually mixed in mono instead of stereo. Possibly as a result of this upbringing, Dennis didn't really like music as a kid. In fact, it's more remarkable that his two brothers did. But they did. Dennis called himself a duck that was born with 2 chickens. In the evenings, at their house in the LA suburbs, Murray would sit down at the family's Hammond organ and young Brian and Carl would harmonize. Dennis would go out and play baseball, swim in the ocean, or get into fights with neighborhood kids. His most prized possession was his BB gun. As the only Wilson not interested in pursuing music, Murray beat Dennis the most and the hardest. When Brian, Carl, Mike Love, and their friend Al Jardine formed the Beach Boys in 1961, Dennis joined reluctantly. They were called the Pendletones then, and didn't intend to be entirely surfing or beach-themed. Some sources claim that they were originally founded by just Brian and Mike, and Brian named them Carl and the Passions to entice Carl into joining, but that was either a previous band Brian attempted to start in his early teens or a myth Brian made up years later. Brian and Carl didn't necessarily want Dennis to join, and he didn't want to join either. It was their parents who forced Dennis to be part of the Beach Boys. Your brothers are doing something cool. Don't you want to join them? It would be a shame if your brothers and your cousin got famous and you just stayed a beach bum in California, right? Wouldn't that suck, Dennis? No, don't apologize to us. Doesn't have anything to do with us. Apologize to yourself, Dennis. And what the hell? They needed a drummer. Dennis decided to learn the drums precisely because he didn't consider himself a musician, but he ended up being one of the most important contributors to the band right from the get-go. What would they write songs about? Dennis was really getting into surfing around then. Why not write a song about surfing, he suggested. For the first few years of the Beach Boys, their music was written by Brian, and the lyrics were written by Mike, but the songs were about the lifestyle that only Dennis really enjoyed. Maybe as musicians, Brian was the Beach Boys, but as cultural ambassadors of California, that review in NME was right. Dennis Wilson was the Beach Boys. He was the heartthrob, the fan favorite. I had a cool middle school history teacher who had seen all the greatest bands of the 60s when he was young, and he claimed that he was at a Beach Boys concert, I think in the Pacific Northwest, in 1964 or 65, after which girls swarmed the stage and broke Dennis's arm. I can find no record of that ever happening, and considering that he was the drummer, if Dennis broke his arm during a tour, that would have seriously cramped the boy's style for months. Maybe this was just a rumor, but I have no trouble believing girls swarmed the stage after the show, trying to touch Dennis. He was treated like Elvis. Although Dennis most embodied the Beach Bum subculture the boys promoted, he also supported Brian's effort to move the Beach Boys beyond that. As Brian began taking psychedelics, writing intricate vocal and instrumental arrangements in multiple different keys at once, and inventing new recording techniques from whole cloth, Dennis stood by him, even as the rest of the band was uncertain. They didn't want to be side characters in the Brian Wilson band, but Dennis explicitly did. On Beach Boys records, Brian increasingly replaced Dennis with a session drummer, Hal Blaine, but unlike the other Beach Boys, he was fine with being replaced in the studio. Starting out in the band as a non-musician left him with a lifelong inferiority complex. Ultimately, he did like music, and he had an ear for it, exceeding everyone in the band but Brian. But Dennis never saw himself that way. The line I quoted in the intro, "We're his fucking messengers, he is all of it," comes from around this era. Dennis wanted to be a musician in his own right, but his brother was Brian Wilson. He'd grown up being known as the Wilson who isn't into music, and so he sold himself short, believing that his calling in life would only ever be as Brian Wilson's hype man. You can watch my previous Beach Boys video to see how Brian's push ended up in more detail, but long story short, he created what's generally considered to be one of the best albums ever made, Pet Sounds, partially completed an album he and Dennis claimed would be even better, Smile, obliterated the Beach Boys' commercial success in America for a decade, with a modest wave of success in Europe as a consolation prize, and absolutely destroyed Brian's mental health for the rest of his life. The fans blame the failure of Smile and the premature end to Brian's most creative period on Mike Love's opposition. He's famously quoted as telling Brian, "Don't fuck with the formula." And while it's not certain if he ever really said that, he definitely thought it. If only the failure of Brian's great artistic ambition was that simple. I love Dennis Wilson, but by constantly acting as his brother's promoter, insisting to the media that the next Beach Boys album would be the most amazing, unique thing you'd ever heard, turning up the heat on Brian, he may bear as much responsibility for Brian's collapse as Mike does. After Brian's role in the band began shrinking, Dennis became seen as the keeper of the Beach Boys' creative flame. He still insisted, "That unreleased Smile album was so good, it makes Pet Sounds stink." For the first time, in the late 60s, Dennis began writing some of his own songs. To everyone's surprise, especially his own, they were good. He went through his first divorce around this time. The Beach Boys were at an inflection point. Whatever the future held, when all else failed, there was always Dennis's first love, the sea. Throughout the 60s, he would still swim or surf nearly every day. Some people recognized him as Dennis Wilson from the Beach Boys. Others just saw him as a friendly surfer dude who dispensed pearls of wisdom and loved helping people out. By 1968, the Beach Boys were old hat in their original LA stomping grounds, more likely to sell out a stadium in Copenhagen than California. Perhaps Dennis was happy to not get mobbed by girls anymore and interact with ordinary surfers and hippies as one of them, not a celebrity. Then again, he was divorced now, and still only 23. He could stand to be mobbed by girls, at least a little bit. One day in April 68, Dennis was driving through Malibu, heading out to the beach, and picked up two young women hitchhiking, as he was known to do. He did this all the time, just because he loved people. He probably wanted to get laid too, and he probably would, because he was the drummer for the Beach Boys, but he didn't just want to get laid. He began talking to these two girls about the trip the Beach Boys had just done to India, where, along with the Beatles, they'd studied meditation at an ashram under the supervision of the guru Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. "Oh, that's cool," said the girls. "We have a guru, too." It was California in the 60s, so this wasn't as out of left field as it would be in almost any other time or place. Their guru was named Charlie, they said, and he was a musician, just like Dennis. They recommended Dennis meet him sometime, and Dennis said he would. Turns out he would meet Charlie much sooner than planned. Dennis had a recording session later that day for the Beach Boys album Friends, and when he came back to his house on Sunset Boulevard in the evening, he found it swarmed by about a dozen girls, some of them still teenagers, and there among them was Charlie. Diane Lake, one of the girls, later said, Dennis and Charlie hit it off right away, which is not surprising, given Charlie's skills in ingratiating himself with strangers. Dennis, in no rush to leave, hung out for a while, smoking some pot with himself with strangers. It was obvious from the start that Dennis liked the girls and admired Charlie's harem. We sat at Charlie's feet and looked at him lovingly as he sang to girls. We made sure Dennis saw how much we idolized Charlie. We knew that was our job, without Charlie even having to tell us. When Charlie played his guitar, Dennis was entranced. Lake says that Charlie played guitar well enough, and Dennis, a self-taught drummer, hardly played at all. So Charlie began to show him how. Watching them together, they connected with each other. Dennis's good looks gave him the kind of magnetism perfect for Charlie. Charlie quickly keyed into his soft spots. Within days, Charlie and his harem were living with Dennis, who provided for all their needs. Dennis took everyone to get treated for gonorrhea because it made the group sex, quote, painful and not particularly joyous. This cost a lot, which Dennis was happy to pay out of pocket, even though he didn't often participate in Charlie's orgies himself. Like everyone around this time, Dennis was getting into meditation and mindfulness and became interested in relinquishing his material possessions. He'd amassed quite a lot of those as a rock star, and now he was sick of the superficiality of it all. And now he had to support 17 young hippies and their guru? Well, two birds with one stone. Dennis gave Charlie his Rolls Royce, his Ferrari, his Mercedes, designer clothes, hundreds of thousands of dollars. In interviews with the music press, Dennis raved about this weird guy who had stepped into his life and turned everything upside down in the best way possible. He said Charlie had filled him with a sense of joy, wonder, and adventure. He told the rest of the band that Charlie was a wizard, man. He is gas. In a truly surreal December 1968 interview, Dennis said he was writing songs with Charlie, but also put him down, saying, "He's dumb in some ways, but I accept his approach and have learned from him." All his material possessions had gone to Charlie. As for Dennis himself, quote, "Now I live in one small room with one candle, and I'm happy finding myself." Even for 1968, this was weird. Even at the time, people began to worry, including Dennis's bandmates, that Dennis was becoming a member of a cult. If I may psychoanalyze Dennis Wilson a bit, I think he was so attracted to Charlie, and put him down in an interview, because Dennis saw in Charlie exactly what he wanted to be. Dennis had been rocketed to stardom when his parents forced him to join the family band, and he'd gotten all the money and girls he could ever dream of, but he was still an odd man out in the band, just the drummer and not a very good one at that. To Dennis, as much as he wanted his rock and roll lifestyle, he didn't feel like he deserved it. Now here comes Charlie. He's no rock star. He's been in and out of jail for petty crimes half his life. And he's gotten all these girls purely out of his own charisma. 17 women. Not even Mick Jagger traveled around with a harem of 17 adoring women. And Charlie was also a musician, a better musician than Dennis, in Dennis's eyes. And that was completely tangential to his success in his social life. Charlie had everything Dennis wanted without doing a goddamn thing, despite being dumb. If Dennis already believed his life was to be devoted to standing in others' shadows, this cemented it. Dennis suggested that Charlie come to Brian's studio to record his music. Dennis introduced him to the music producer Terry Melcher to jumpstart his music career. Melcher was the son of the classic Hollywood star Doris Day and one of the most sought-after producers in LA at the time. He had produced the Byrds' hits Mr. Tambourine Man and Turn, Turn, Turn. Melcher did show interest in Charlie and listened to the songs he'd recorded with Dennis. He decided Charlie was not talented enough and didn't offer him a recording contract. Dennis invited his bandmates to come visit. Mike Love said at one dinner, Dennis invited him and Bruce Johnston, the sixth Beach Boy who had joined in 1965 after previously being in a band with Terry Melcher. At the dinner, Mike said there were several women attending to Dennis, Charlie, and another man who introduced himself as Tex Watson. Bruce and Mike Love were the only ones with clothes on. Quote, "Everybody else was completely naked, so first of all, that's a little weird." Right after dinner, Charlie invited everybody to go into a den area and turn on a strobe light and passed out what was said to be acid, which I declined. I wasn't interested in doing that, nor was I interested in joining the bodies that were, you know, on the floor. When Mike sought to leave, Charlie confronted him, saying he couldn't do that. Mike described Charlie's look as pretty intense. Mike told him that he needed to get back to the studio. En route to Brian Wilson's house, he said he thought, "Well, Dennis, you've really got him. You really got something on your hands now." Dennis still tried to make Charlie into a star, or use Charlie's talent to boost his own career. On the Beach Boys' 1969 album 2020, there was a song called Never Learn Not to Love, a bluesy little number, honestly one of the most mid moments of one of the Beach Boys' most mid albums of that era. The song credited Dennis as its writer, but it was originally written by Charlie, under the title Cease to Exist. Everyone has a different story for how this song ended up being recorded by the Beach Boys. Charlie later said he'd written the song specifically so the Beach Boys could record it. Dennis said he'd liked the song enough that he asked Charlie if he could record it and managed to get the song credited only to himself by giving Charlie either a hefty sum of money or a motorcycle, or both, depending on which source you go with. Dennis knew the rest of the band was suspicious of Charlie, and when he presented his bandmates with the song Cease to Exist, according to Mike Love, they all thought Dennis had written it. They reworked it together, changing lyrics, adding hooks, and letting Brian compose elaborate vocal arrangements. Either way, even if Charlie had willingly forked over the song to Dennis, the fact that the Beach Boys had changed the lyrics and title made him blow his top. This was when Dennis finally realized the trouble he was in and began trying to extricate himself from the situation. According to some sources, Charlie had happily handed over the song to Dennis, but only after stipulating that he couldn't change any of the lyrics. After the song was released, Charlie purportedly left a bullet in Dennis's bed. On another occasion, Van Dyke Parks, a singer-songwriter who Brian had brought on to write lyrics for Smile, claims he witnessed Charlie hold up a bullet to Dennis and threaten Dennis's two young children, who weren't present. Dennis, always the strongest, tallest, most athletic Beach Boy, beat the shit out of Charlie. Over the next few weeks, he evicted Charlie and his followers, letting them keep almost all of his worldly possessions in exchange for leaving him alone. Well, Charlie left him alone for a little while. In August 1969, Dennis woke up to find Charlie banging on his door. He demanded money and said he'd just been to the moon, which Dennis interpreted as a reference to his increasing psychedelic use. Charlie and his girls were almost constantly tripping by the time Dennis got rid of them, another reason he began to fear them. But that was not what Mr. Charles Manson and his cult had done that night. On August 8th, 1969, Charlie told his second-in-command, Tex Watson, to drive some of the girls to a particular house in the Hollywood Hills and kill everyone inside. The house belonged to disgraced but legendary filmmaker Roman Polanski and his pregnant girlfriend Sharon Tate. Polanski wasn't home, but Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring, who was a hairstylist and former flame of Tate, ended up being tied up and murdered. Two friends, a screenwriter and the heiress to the Folgers coffee fortune, were also visiting. The screenwriter was stabbed to death, and the heiress fled the house with 28 stab wounds. Stephen Parent, a recent high school graduate who had stopped by the house to visit the 19-year-old caretaker William Gerritsen, was shot to death as he was leaving the property. Manson himself wasn't there that night, but he would get involved the next night, murdering a young couple seemingly at random with four of his followers. To this day, the motive for these murders, and the other ones that, unbeknownst to Dennis, the cult had already committed, is completely unknown. You might have heard that Manson believed, or at least taught his followers, that the ongoing civil rights movement at the time was about to explode into an apocalyptic race war, which would destroy civilization and leave the Manson family free to take over the world in the war's ashes. Manson called this scenario Helter Skelter, after the Beatles song, and the prosecutor on Manson's case claimed that his murders were false flags meant to make white Californians suspect black radicals, which would hasten Helter Skelter. Purportedly, the messages some of the Manson girls wrote in blood on the victims' walls were intended to make cops think the crimes were done by black people. Political piggy, death to pigs, and simply rise. This whole story is in dispute to this day. The whole Helter Skelter thing comes from a single source, a former friend of Manson named Paul Watkins, who testified at Manson's trial. Other members of the cult who testified say Manson had some kind of elaborate conspiracy belief that he called Helter Skelter, but evidence seems to suggest that most of the women didn't know much about it. Another story is that the murders of Sharon Tate and friends, at least, were carried out as revenge against Dennis Wilson. Sharon Tate had just moved into the house where she was killed. It used to belong to Terry Melcher, the producer who Dennis had introduced Manson to, who had rejected Manson as a songwriter. Again, Manson wasn't there at the scene of the crime. He just told his followers to go to a particular address and kill everyone inside. So, could he have intended to kill Melcher? Some sources say this was probably the motive, but it was most likely more complicated because of an encounter an Iranian photographer had with Manson several months before the death of Sharon Tate. The photographer was at Tate's house to do a photo shoot of her, and Manson came to the door asking for someone the photographer wasn't familiar with, presumably Terry Melcher. The photographer said this was Sharon Tate's house, and Manson left. Later that day, Manson came back and talked to Rudy Altobelli, who owned the house and rented it to Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. Again, he asked to see Terry Melcher. Altobelli, who had met Manson before at Dennis Wilson's house and was scared of him, told him that Melcher had moved and Altobelli didn't know where he lived now, although this was a lie to protect Melcher. At the trial, it was alleged that while the Manson family committed these crimes to hasten Helter Skelter, Manson chose this particular house to intimidate Melcher, even though he knew he didn't live there anymore. A further strange twist, only uncovered in a 2019 book that re-examines the existing narratives about the Manson family, is the apparent evidence that Terry Melcher actually stayed in Manson's good graces even after the murders. Police files indicate that Manson regularly visited the house when Melcher lived there, even after Melcher rejected Manson's music, and Melcher was carrying on a sexual relationship with a 15-year-old Manson family member for 4 months after the murder. The truth may never be known. Either way, Melcher managed to extricate himself from the Manson rumors and continue a middlingly successful career as a producer. His later involvement with the Beach Boys, now this is a fun tidbit, was as producer on their 1992 album Summer in Paradise, their only album with zero contributions from Brian, and famously considered one of the worst albums of all time. Not everyone in the Manson family had enough evidence to charge or even arrest them. As Manson went to trial, many members of the family were still out on the streets, and Dennis Wilson received enough credible death threats that he refused to testify against Manson. All Dennis ever said regarding his Manson connection was in 1976, where he told Rolling Stone regarding his relationship with the Manson family that, "As long as I live, I'll never talk about that." Dennis also said, in his 1978 biography, The Beach Boys and the California Myth, quote, "I know why Manson did what he did. Someday I'll tell the world. I'll write a book and explain why he did it." That book was never written. Mike Love said that Dennis's involvement with Manson was the worst thing that could possibly happen to the band. It was a, quote, "unfortunate episode that brought Satan into our midst."
Hey, we got Satan!
You are not.
Shaken by the Manson saga, Dennis poured himself into music over the next few years, learning several instruments and becoming one of the Beach Boys' main songwriters. What Brian started in terms of creativity and emotional depth, Dennis saw himself as responsible for finishing. On their 1970 album Sunflower, Dennis wrote Forever, a gorgeous, simple, wedding-ready ballad that's still, today, one of the greatest Beach Boys songs. I'm trying to keep this video monetized, but I have a soundtrack in a pinned comment. Go listen to Forever, right now. Brian was still around, but he was beginning to go down the weird childish path that I talked about in my episode about him, writing songs about health food and magic radios. What Dennis wrote was devastating. Many of his songs were left off Beach Boys albums for being too depressing and have only surfaced on fan bootlegs. Go down to the pinned comment and listen, once you're done with Forever, to Carry Me Home, about a dying soldier. The other thing Dennis poured into himself was alcohol. Brian's mental health had been permanently ruined by constant psychedelic use, and Dennis wasn't much more abstemious, he just seemed to be a more high-functioning person in general. Brian would be formally diagnosed with schizophrenia in the 1980s and was probably also autistic. Dennis was never diagnosed with anything, but anecdotes from people he hung out with suggest he could have been bipolar. Sterling Smith of the obscure prog rock band The Load commented that when they were practicing at their apartment in Venice Beach at one point in the 70s, there was a loud banging on the front door. It was Dennis. The Load would normally practice at the Beach Boys studio, and Dennis would hang out with them pretty often. He came in, quote, "sweating, crying, and laughing," stated, "I did it! I did it! I burned it up!" They looked down the alley and found that he had set fire to a car. It was either his third wife Karen Lamb's car or his own. They walked down to see a friend to get some weed, and Wilson was, quote, kicking trash barrels, and he's really got this amazing wired energy. And then within 10 minutes, he's normal again. He was also constantly drinking, constantly snorting coke, and constantly getting into dumb accidents. In 1971, while he was drunk, he punched right through a glass door, seriously injuring his hand and requiring the band to bring on a new drummer for a few years, a Malaysian South African guy named Ricky Fattar. This is how I know my middle school teacher's story must be misremembered, because Dennis did have a career-limiting injury later on in his career, and we know a lot about it. There'd have been documentation if he'd broken his arm back in the 60s. Still writing songs, but sidelined from playing with the band, Dennis spiraled further and further. Dennis had always lived something of a nomadic life. He hadn't had a fixed address since back when he evicted the Manson family. He'd only intermittently ever even had his own car. His second love was music, his third may have been sex and drugs, but his first love was always, always, always the Pacific Ocean. Throughout most of the 70s, Dennis lived on a boat, appropriately named the Harmony, docked in Marina del Rey. He would go swimming off the deck of the Harmony every day. In the mid-70s, the Beach Boys experienced a revival in fortunes, partially due to promotion from a short-lived new manager, Jack Riley. But this revival was all about their old 60s beach culture music. Nobody was interested in hearing Dennis's dirge-like songs. Dennis's friend and occasional songwriting partner, Greg Jacobson, said that the Beach Boys were trying to match an image and that they had an image for their music. Dennis didn't try to fit in. Whatever he was feeling went on the tapes. So, Dennis began working on a solo album, Pacific Ocean Blue, released in 1977. He was still a member of the Beach Boys at this point, and at the same time in the same studio where he was working on Pacific Ocean Blue, he was contributing to the Beach Boys album Love You, the deliciously weird, mostly electronic album Brian made during the depths of his addiction and seclusion. Both of the troubled Wilson brothers released haunting, raw, confessional solo albums in 1977. Love You was basically a solo Brian project, and the contrast between the two couldn't have been stronger. Listening to them back to back, you'd never guess that Brian is the one considered a visionary arranging genius and composer equivalent to Bach, and Dennis is the autodidact who only became interested in music after he was forced to join the band. Love You, Brian's album, is full-on outsider music. 90% of the instruments are low-quality early analog synthesizers, and the lyrics are bizarre and sometimes creepy. This is, of course, what makes Love You a masterpiece, as I explain in more detail in my Brian episode, but Pacific Ocean Blue is a more conventional masterpiece. It's a cry for help, but a gorgeous one, set to sweeping strings, dissonant horns, soundscapes that suggest the album's title more than anything. One retrospective review compared it to Kurt Cobain produced by Phil Spector. But it has one compositional feature that's unmistakably Wilsonian. All the left turns it takes. Few songs on Pacific Ocean Blue have a clear verse-chorus structure. Most of them go through many key changes. The mood changes abruptly, again and again and again. Brian's would-be masterpiece, Smile, with Dennis as its number one cheerleader, used a modular recording technique, with literally hundreds of short, recurring snatches of music mixed and matched and compressed into a single LP. Brian basically invented sampling. Pacific Ocean Blue sounds exactly the same, which seems like it would be disjointed, and on Smile it is. Maybe if Smile had ever been formally finished and stitched into a coherent record, it wouldn't have sounded disjointed, but maybe it would. After all, nobody really composed and recorded music that way before Brian made Smile, and first editions are often buggy. On Pacific Ocean Blue, it works. Every song sounds like one coherent song, capable of standing on its own, but it also sounds like 10 songs in one. John Hanlon, an audio engineer, said of Dennis during the Pacific Ocean Blue sessions that, "I thought he was really avant-garde. He was an amazing artist. He wasn't afraid to experiment, to fall into space. He was very out there. He wasn't afraid of being different." Dennis's voice was described as, quote, "sandpapered by cocaine to almost a single octave. It was always intimate and expressive." The cover shows Dennis, haggard and beaten down at just 32, not coincidentally looking quite a bit like his more famous brother, with Wilson in huge letters. Only once you pick up the vinyl do you see the Dennis above it, but Pacific Ocean Blue is unquestionably equal to most of Brian's work. I want you to pause this video right now and listen to Dennis's song Thoughts of You. Isn't that incredible? That's from 1977. It starts out sounding like something by Phil Elverum or Elliot Smith, the sort of confessional emo indie singer-songwriter you only really start getting in the 90s. I guess Alex Chilton was a precedent to that. But then you get to that monumental shift. Did you ever hear Alex Chilton do something like that? And then, like an average day in the life of Dennis Wilson circa 1977, it crashes back down from its euphoric high to its devastating low. Brian Wilson had his gorgeously arranged and sonically innovative albums like Pet Sounds and Smile, and his raw emotional albums like Love You and Adult Child, but he never mixed personal confession with artistic experimentation quite as well as his brother did on Pacific Ocean Blue. Pacific Ocean Blue didn't sell. It sold a little better than the albums released around then under the Beach Boys' name, but that was cold comfort because nobody bought Love You either. Pacific Ocean Blue ended up going out of print for decades. Pristine copies of the original vinyl fetch hundreds of dollars. The only Beach Boys records still selling were the ones from the Fun in the Sun era, so that's the direction Mike Love demanded the band should go. Brian was too drugged out to protest, and Dennis was on his way there too, though not before announcing that he, quote, hoped that karma would fuck up Mike Love's meditation forever. Dennis only recorded about half of a follow-up album to Pacific Ocean Blue, which was going to be called Bamboo, but it was never finished. Steve Levine, the producer, said that it failed partially because Dennis had begun to get into heroin. It began to seriously damage him by 1978, and during the Beach Boys tour in Australia, he had to check into a hospital to get cleaned up. Christine McVie of Fleetwood Mac described her romance with Dennis, which began at the end of 1978, that, quote, it was probably the experience of a lifetime. Half of him was like a little boy, and the other half was insane. A really split personality. McVie dedicated the song Only Over You on Fleetwood Mac's 1982 album Mirage to Dennis. And you know that song, even if you don't think you do. Dennis also had bouts of drunken destruction where he would destroy everything in the house. Steve Goldberg, a close friend of Dennis, said that he used her place like a hospital. I'd go and pick him up and she wouldn't see him for a week. When he was totaled out, he wouldn't sleep for a week. He'd go back, over and over again. He cared about her, but his priority was having a good time. By 1979, the band had enough, and as Dennis missed tours and when he did show up, he was too messed up to play, he was kicked out of the Beach Boys, but he rejoined the band in 1980. Steve Goldberg said that when Dennis was with McVie, quote, he was doing lots of coke. He turned to drinking to ease the shakes from the coke. By the time he moved to Venice Beach to live with his daughter, he was carrying around a ready-mixed jug. It just progressed to a continual drink. By the 80s, the remaining sober Beach Boys, Mike Love, Carl Wilson, Al Jardine, Bruce Johnston, and their manager Tom Hewlett, had two key problems, Brian Wilson and Dennis Wilson. Despite attempts by the rest of the band to keep the two of them apart, Dennis had gotten Brian to collaborate with him on an album's worth of songs in 1981 by plying his brother with cocaine and McDonald's. These tapes have never been released and are popularly called the Cocaine Sessions or Hamburger Sessions. Brian was sent to residential treatment under the care of the evil, sadistic psychotherapist Eugene Landy, who he wouldn't be freed from until the 90s. Watch the amazing movie Love and Mercy, starring me as the younger Brian, for an account of this period of Brian's life. As for Dennis, he was told he could not tour unless he went into detox. They were all genuinely interested in helping him. In November 1983, Dennis checked into a country club-style rehab center in Arizona, but he left after 2 days. On the 23rd of December, after a period where nobody knew where he was, Dennis checked into St. John's Hospital and Health Center in Santa Monica. The doctor treating him, Dr. Joichi Takamine, said he seemed, quote, very serious about sticking to the program. But after just a few days, he was gone again. Wilson would die on December 28th, 1983, at the age of 39, destroyed by his addictions and virtually homeless. He went diving into the waters of Marina del Rey after drinking on a friend's boat. The marina was where he had had his own boat, the Harmony, a few years back. After he divorced his wife, Karen Lamb, for the second time in 1978, he threw her jewelry into the water off the deck of the Harmony. Now the boat was gone, and he wanted those fragments of his old life back. Ultimately, diving for the jewelry, he drowned in the same spot where he had lived in the 70s. Tom Murphy, whose home studio was used by Dennis in the early 80s, said, "Everybody loved Dennis, but I'm not sure Dennis loved himself." Stephen Kalinich, A poet who had hung out with and occasionally wrote lyrics with the Beach Boys said that, quote, "Dennis drowned before he ever hit the water. I think if he had more outlets and encouragement with his creative expression, he might have taken a less destructive path. That was his way out of it, but when he was blocked and he did not have the familiar tools and the studio around him, it was like a person without a country." His former friend Ed Roach best summed him up by saying that Dennis was a damaged soul and a haunted man. There was, quote, "melancholy and painfulness in him. That is why he always kept this high level of energy going on. Whether it was jumping in the ocean or jumping on stage or jumping into being the life of the party, then he never really had to deal with it. He just kept raising the bar, a little bit more and a little bit more until eventually it just all crashed down on him. And once it did, then it all magnified. And all the demons started coming in and just ate him alive." Dennis's legacy is best remembered through Pacific Ocean Blue, his magnum opus. I'll let you in on a fun tour lore drop. My previous Beach Boys episode got me my girlfriend. I live here in New York because of my amazing girlfriend, and we met because she was a fan who had the guts to DM me on Instagram and say, "Hi, I'm autistic, I love the Beach Boys too, and by the way, I'm a model and I think you're hot." My initial thought was, damn, these spam bots are getting more targeted. But I looked up her name and I found a CV from a modeling agency. One thing turned into another, and now I live in her apartment. She knew about all the weird twists and turns of Brian's life, about Pet Sounds, about Smile, and about Love You, but she had never listened to Pacific Ocean Blue, and actually until recently, neither had I. The Beach Boys have so much unreleased material, no artist lends itself to more of an iceberg meme. You get down to a depth where myth and reality blur. There's a long-standing rumor that Brian burned the tapes for a song intended for Smile because he thought it was cursed, which probably isn't true, and don't get me started on Song to God. But Pacific Ocean Blue may be the lowest on the iceberg that anything officially released by a Beach Boy gets. The best way to think about Pacific Ocean Blue is as an alternate universe version of Smile. Imagine a world where Brian Wilson completed Smile and it really was everything his boosters hoped for. It really did establish the Beach Boys as equals to the Beatles, both creatively and commercially. It became known as one of the best albums of all time, better than Pet Sounds, permanently relegating the Beach Boys' hot rod days to a bit of early installment weirdness from America's most innovative band. What would that version of Smile have sounded like? You can listen to various bootlegged mixes of Smile online. They're pretty good. It would have been an interesting album, to be sure. My 16-year-old self is pulling a full-on tantrum to see me saying something bad about Smile here, but Smile is so esoteric and impenetrable, I don't think a finished Smile could have hit the same balance of artistic innovation and mass appeal that the Beatles consistently managed to hit. It's worth noting that Brian himself was asked once, if Smile had been released, would it have been better than Sgt. Pepper? And he said, no. Sgt. Pepper would have blown us out of the water. Smile was always destined to be a cult record. An album that feels like it could have been released in 1967, but would have been mind-blowingly innovative for that year, that the Beach Boys could have realistically made and dropped the jaws of the world with, that sounds precisely like a more eclectic, psychedelic Pet Sounds, an album that sounds exactly like what someone who only knows the Beach Boys from their sunny hits would expect a Beach Boys album that is dark, challenging, gorgeous, avant-garde, and yet universally accessible to sound like, is Pacific Ocean Blue. This world is not possible. All the songs on Pacific Ocean Blue were written by Dennis Wilson in the 70s, not Brian in the 60s. But it's uncanny how easy it is to picture hippies during the Summer of Love waiting in line for the groundbreaking new Beach Boys album. The Beatles put out Sgt. Pepper a few weeks ago. Where does music go from there? How is it possible to innovate any further? It's not easy to exaggerate how big of a deal Sgt. Pepper was at the time. Well, Melody Maker said this new release from the Beach Boys, Smile, is even better. Instead of Smiley Smile, the album they really did put out in 1967, which I love now but is very weird and very much an acquired taste, I hated it for years even when I loved the Smile bootlegs, this has the iconic Smile Shop cover. A group of friends gingerly carry the LP back to their tiny apartment, roll a joint, put Smile on the turntable, the needle drops, and it's the album we know as Pacific Ocean Blue. It feels like it belongs in that scene. It's a melancholy album, much sadder than most of the stuff other artists were putting out around then, but so was Pet Sounds. It doesn't have wacky innovations like sitars or a whole song where the lyrics come from a Victorian circus poster, but in light of the Beach Boys' direct, profound songwriting and unexpected melodic shifts, those things just feel like gimmicks. And then the Beatles hear it and go, bloody hell, and set off to somehow improve on what they've heard. The symbiotic co-evolution of the Beatles and Beach Boys continues for years, comes to be the defining cultural event of the 60s. And then the album people in this timeline know as Smile, and in ours know as Pacific Ocean Blue, gets overplayed, and it makes you look dumb to mention it when people are naming what they think the best album ever made is. Covers of even the lesser tracks are unavoidable at open mic nights. The climax of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet in this universe takes place to the bridge in Thoughts of You, and all the critics recognize its inclusion as a self-aware reference to how Thoughts of You is incredibly overused in movie scenes like these. In that sense, I'm glad Pacific Ocean Blue stayed obscure, and I can rant to people who, even if they clicked thinking they know about the weird years of the Beach Boys, may have never heard it. Pacific Ocean Blue came out a decade too late, and it was made by the Wilson brother who wasn't a musician, who was just a drummer, who loved surfing more than songs about surfing, who was only ever Brian's hype man, right? Early on, when the Beach Boys were five smiling boys in the sand, most of them still teenagers, Dennis wrote this in the liner notes to their 1964 album All Summer Long. They say I live a fast life. Maybe I just like a fast life. I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world. It won't last forever either, but the memories will. I hope they will, Dennis. I hope they will.
Save the blame.